I wanted to mention, because I didn't really directly do it last week or the week before, but the same handout has been at the beginning of the class for the last 2 weeks and this week, but it's just about this module. So how to access the readings online, which were the homework last week and the week before. So if that's not at all clear, please ask. I can like open my computer, help you find them, but it's pretty detailed on here how to get to that. And then about watching class online if you miss one, and there's an email if you ever have a question about something logistical. I can answer it for you, hopefully. So there's an email for the program on here. And then on this side, it's kind of how to follow along, keep track of what meditations you've been doing and what reading you've been doing, so that at the end of this, you want to get a certificate, you can. If you filled out a completion card for the first module and you want your certificate, it's at the back of the room. If it's not there for some reason, let me know. A couple people picked up their completion card but not their certificate, so I actually like printed a certificate with a pretty flower on it and everything so you can double check and make sure you got that. We'll continue to use the microphone during question time. If anybody wants to help, I'll be on this side of the room. You know, you can always just kind of jump up and grab the mic and offer to, like, you know, put it in front of people. If you're, like, cool with crouching around and stalking people and things like that, that's a great job for you. Speaking of jobs, what I wanted to do for us is kind of get a list of people who kind of get here early, some people that stay late, so you guys get to know each other and we can all help each other with the kinds of setup and things that need to be done beforehand and then cleaning up. It's a great way to offer service to the center and to, you know, get your mind here and focused, and you learn something usually, and you get to meet people and talk to them, so that's great too. So I have a piece of paper in the front, and the idea is we'll just kind of get to know each other. We do not have class next week. I think okay. Some people are already on Thanksgiving break today, but
I'm glad you told me because I was going to show up.
You had a good meditation practice. So we'll take 1 week off. So this is 3 weeks in November, 1 week off, 3 weeks in December. That's what this module is. So you get to continue to recover from Thanksgiving on Monday. That's all I have. Thanks. It'll be the good stuff.
I'm trying to see what time it is. It's not quite time yet, I guess. I'll wait for a couple of minutes. Well, maybe we'll get started now. So, yep, it's 7. So welcome again. I see that the class has dropped by about a half, which is what I expected, you know. That's usually how it goes. So this is the third class, right? So the first one, John talked about the basics of the, or not the basics, but the, you know, the foundational things, like the, you know, the, what the mind is and how it functions and why do we want to, I guess, transform it, you know. And then last one, we talked about, you know, some of the obstacles to meditation and how to kind of get past them, right? So today, I thought that we'd start with a kind of a what a normal meditation session might be like. Well, it's not for you. Today is going to be a long one. Maybe it'll take 20 minutes, half hour, something like that. I'm not saying your meditation needs to be half an hour. It's going to take that long because, you know, we're going to do a lot of different things and you can pick and choose what you want to do, right? So you get a flavor of how to do it. And then let's see, what do we talk about? Well, we'll talk about kind of the different types of meditations. There's a few different types, a few general categories. And maybe if we have time, we'll meditate in one of them. Let's see. So, okay. So, you remember the 9-round breathing, right, that we talked about last time? If you don't, then we will do it in the beginning, but I'll kind of review it, right? So this is it's a good way to remove or to eliminate stale or negative energies that have gathered throughout the day, right? Things that kind of unsettle the mind when we're trying to meditate, right? So this is a way of kind of preparing for meditation, right? So let's see. So what do? We close off our left nostril, breathe in through our right, and out through our left. We do that 3 times. And again. A lot slower when we really do it, of course. And then we close off our right nostril, breathe in through our left, and then out through the right 3 times. And then we breathe in through both nostrils and out through both nostrils, right? So that's the kind of the gist. Okay. So let's take if you remember the 7-point, the posture. If you're sitting on a cushion, you can try to do that. If you're on the chair, most of it is still applicable. But just the back, try to, if possible, try not to lean on the chair, back of the chair, because then you tend to kind of slouch. It's important to kind of have the back, relatively straight but relaxed, right? That's, the energies flow better that way. It might have been the real train, it almost sounded like. Anyway, okay. So let's get started. So let's do our 9-round breathing meditation. Remember to breathe in down into the belly. So one of the important things is to try to have as relaxed a body as possible, because whatever's going on in the body affects the mind, and vice versa, of course. But in meditation, it's important for a relaxed body. And so sometimes, you know, you might find that your body is kind of, you know, there's itches and pains and this and that. It's a good thing to do a body scan. So you start basically at the bottom of your feet, you know, the toes, the bottom of your feet. And you just, you know, put your concentration there, right? Notice whether it's tense. Is it relaxed? How does it feel? And you can breathe into it if you feel tension. And imagine that, you know, the tension melts away. So like that, we walk up to our calves. To our knees. Our thighs. The back of our thighs, around the buttocks. Our belly. Chest. Our shoulders. And then our hands and elbows and arms. And then just feel how it, or see how your face feels, you know. Are there muscles that are tense? Maybe you're clenching your jaw. Maybe your brow is furrowed. It's all around. Another thing one can do is you can imagine, you know, or just the space around us, like it's a space of goodness, you know, however that appears, or however that, you know, whatever that means to you. So from the space of goodness, white light just pours into us. You know, flushing out all the tension, giving us all the blessings. So those kind of things just bring us to a frame of mind that's now ready for meditation. So before we start the actual session, we always set the motivation that, you know, we're doing, why are we doing this? What is the object? What do we hope to achieve? So we can think about, you know, the, you know, meditation is about transforming the mind. But why transform the mind? What's wrong with it now? and so it's, you know, our minds are filled with delusions which bring us suffering. Not just this life, not the next, not just the previous, but from beginningless time all the way until we gain enlightenment. We are under the power of these delusions. So taming our minds to remove these delusions is the most important thing we could do in this life. But just working for ourselves isn't enough, because others around us are suffering just like we are. They're no different from us. Their minds are similarly deluded. They engage in negative behaviors. So we can, you know, we're doing this practice not just for ourselves, but so that we can help others. You know, we can lead the way for others as well. So that's the expansive motivation of the bodhisattvas, you know, the bodhicitta motivation. So it's good to start with a motivation like that. And then one thing that Rinpoche says is that it's very important to rejoice. Rejoice in our present circumstances. You know, that our basic needs are taken care of. We have the leisure, you know, to come to take a Monday night off and do this. You know, we live in a relatively free country. You know, we have spiritual teachings that are available to us. And that we are, especially that we have made an effort, not just today, but other days when we come to the center or do other things that are of benefit to others. So rejoice in all our efforts, this life and all our lives in the past and in the future that we are to come. So there's many good things that we have done, will do, and are doing even today. And like that, there are so many others also who have dedicated their lives to helping others. They aren't necessarily Buddhist. You know, they can be of any faith, and or maybe they are non-believers, but they're, you know, they're ethically minded and they benefit others. So there's so many others who are doing, working like this, and we rejoice in their efforts. We rejoice in all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas who are even now, you know, constantly working towards helping beings. You know, our teachers, their efforts. So it's very good to rejoice, and we'll talk more about it later as to why. Yeah, it's very helpful. But it's a good way to remind ourselves that our lives aren't so dim after all. That there are things that we can rejoice about. And now, finally, we're ready to start our meditation. So we'll do about 5 minutes of just concentrating on the breath. So you just, as you breathe in and out, just rest your mind on the feeling, maybe in the nostril as the air comes in, whether it's warm or cold. You can notice that. Or as it moves the passageway, or as your tummy goes in and out. However, wherever you put your focus, just leave it there. And as thoughts come in, let them walk, go by. If your mind wanders, just bring it gently back. And that's it. So we'll do that for 5 minutes. Now let your mind, relax your mind now for just a bit. And you can just let it rest, but try not to have it just go helter-skelter everywhere. So we're kind of taking a break without getting off our seat. And this is maybe for 30 seconds. So, you know, we were using the breath as our object of meditation. But we can also use the mind itself as an object of our meditation. So, you know, when you're ready, we can bring our minds back. And then look, just try to see if you can notice the thing that is aware, that has thoughts. It's as if you have a tiny little mind in one corner that's observing the big expanse of the rest of the mind. As thoughts appear and disappear, you can just notice them. Seeming like float by like clouds in the sky. And try to notice the qualities of that mind, the thing that's aware. Is it, for example, maybe it feels spacious? Maybe it has a color? But nevertheless, it's just there, unperturbed, as things appear and disappear. So that's really the nature of our mind, called the conventional nature of our mind. So I did a lot of things in that, I combined a lot of things in that one session. But the most important thing is to you know, whenever, you know, the 5 minutes, that's all you need to do, right? The meditation in the beginning, as we spoke last time, right? You can do 10 minutes, but maybe you can break it up into 2 5-minute minutes and with a break like we did in the middle, right? But it's, well, we didn't do the dedication. We should have done the dedication, but nevertheless, we'll do it at the end of the session. But the meditations are bookended by the motivation and the dedication, right? There's a reason for that, and we'll talk about it. And also, it's important when we start to bring the mind to a place where it's ready for meditation, right? So the 9-round breathing, you can take 3 deep breaths, you know, if that works. You know, His Holiness Dalai Lama suggests you can do that, for example. You can do the body scan. You can combine them all, you know, however you wish to do that, right? So, you know, and so the motivation, you know, the calming the mind, then the meditation itself, whatever the meditation is, right? And then finally the dedication, right? So that's the session essentially, right? And the whole thing maybe at most 10 minutes, you know? It depends on you, how much time you have, but again, not to overdo it when you start, right? Because that's counterproductive, so you have to pace yourself. So start with 3 minutes even, they say. Then 5, then, you know, 7, then 10, or however you wish. Any questions on what we just did? Okay. Any questions on last time, what we spoke about last time? Oh, if you wouldn't mind using a mic.
This is my first session here.
Mm-hmm.
I'm coming in. I know there's sessions happening, and
that's fine.
I'm just trying to follow up. So when you asked to close the eyes and start meditating, the concentration should be on the breathing, right? While doing the meditation.
Right. So the type of meditation we're doing right now is called concentration meditation, right? And so the idea there is to focus on a particular object. Meditation always has an object, by the way. So sometimes you'll hear, you know, they say, you know, make your mind blank. There is no such thing. You cannot make your mind blank because the mind's function is to have thoughts and plan and things like that, right? So to focus, to concentrate, we actually just have an object. In our case, in this meditation we did, the first meditation we did, was the object was the breath, right? So you just put your mind on the breath, all your focus on it, and it strays, it's okay. You just bring it back gently, right? Without any chatter, right, about whether you can do it or not and so forth and so on, right, without any judgment. And you can just observe, you know, sometimes you notice as you get better at it, you notice thoughts coming and you just don't follow them, right? You just let them float by, right? But your mind is just on the breath, right? So that's basically it. And then second meditation we did, of course, the object was the mind itself, right? So that was another object, right?
So following up my question, when you said mind as an object, I didn't know what exactly that.
Right. So I did it because it's just to kind of have a flavor of, you know, what, you know, other types of objects are like, right? That's a difficult one. It's difficult to find the object, right? How to find the object, you know, the breath is easy, right? How to find the object that's the mind can be difficult. There are various ways, you know, that's written in the scriptures of what you can do. Like, for example, you can kind of look at it and you start asking questions like, you know, where is my mind, right? Is it in my brain? Is it in my body? Is it confined to my brain and body? You know, like, does it have, you know, space, you know, a volume, right? Does it have a color? Where does it, you know, so when you start asking these questions, your mind automatically will kind of just get the spacious feeling, right? You kind of get this feeling of this mind that's like, it's like space, you know? Not space as in just, you know, space in this room, but space that pervades everything, right? My iPad, for example, is that mind is not kind of stuck. I'm kind of really digressing now. But I'll just say for a minute, you know, the mind isn't stopping here and then come, you know, and then again over here, right? This mind just goes right through. It goes, you know, so that's the space we're talking about. It's, you know, it goes through the molecules, through the atoms, you know, it's what matter lives in, right? That's, so you get this feeling of the spaciousness of the mind. And that's when you kind of get the sense that you're getting the object. What I would suggest is, if you want to learn more about it, in the Lam Rim, I don't think that there's much in the Lam Rim about. I think the How to Meditate book, Kathleen McDonald's book, I think actually has a meditation on the mind. So you can look at that, right? And then there's other, I can point you to guided meditations that are on the internet, you know, on the web by qualified teachers, you know, who can also, you can use those as well. But anyway, so to go back, so that was two different objects, right? So like that, one can have different types of objects that you can use, right? Okay, wait a minute. You know, my iPad, it updated the... This doesn't look good. Ah, here we go. Okay. So one thing that I wanted to mention, someone asked me, I think you asked me last time, what is a thought? And I wasn't happy with my answer. I was driving back home, and I was like, you know, I didn't... You know, what you asked me, what is the difference between the mind and the thought, right? Is that what you asked me?
Yeah, thought.
Right. What is a thought? So, you know, a thought is basically a mental state, which is true, but it's not really it's hard to kind of grasp it, right? So you can use kind of like an analogy. And I was just thinking, for example, when you have bubbles in a water, in a stream that's floating, right? And you have water bubbles that are kind of, you see them, right? So the nature of the water bubble is the same as water, right? It's no different, right? But that bubble appears and then just pops and disappears, right? So our thought is like that. A thought is just the bubbles that pop up in our minds, right? And they're no different than the mind. On the other hand, they have a different kind of aspect to it, right? So that's one way to think about it. Okay, anyway.
Question?
Yes, oh, please.
So I've heard people refer to the thought stream.
The thought stream, okay.
Within the mind. What's the difference between the thought stream and the mind? Is the thought stream the bubbles or?
Right. It's the difference between the bubbles and the stream, right? The mind, as I was saying, has a, is a clarity to it, right? They call it the definition of the mind is that it's clear and knowing, right? That there's a clarity, but the clarity isn't enough. It is an awareness, right? It also has to be aware. Otherwise, the mountain lake also has clarity, but that's not the mind, right? So it is clear and knowing. So the thought stream are just, you know, stream of consciousness, you know, things that just come and go throughout the day, you know. But that's not our mind. Our mind is much deeper than that.
So if you are perceiving the thoughts moving through some
medium,
then you're seeing the thoughts, and then the medium is the mind. Is that your
perception? Yeah, in a way. Yeah, that's right. It's kind of like, you know, back in the 19th century, they were wondering, you know, how do, you know, they had radio waves, right? And they were like, how do waves travel, right? And they came up with all these different theories, right? One of the theories was they travel in this ether. Right, they made up this ether in which the waves, because, you know, waves are in water, you know, et cetera, it makes sense, right? Well, anyway, we know that there wasn't an ether. But it's kind of like that. Our thoughts are like that, and it's in an ether, but that ether is our mind, right? But it doesn't have shape, and it doesn't have form. But you have to experience it for yourself, what your mind is like, right? I can't tell you what your mind is like, right? So you have to, if you're interested, you have to do the meditation yourself and see what your mind is like. And the first time, you're not going to get it, and neither the second or the tenth or the hundredth. It takes, you know, you have to keep doing it for quite a long time. But you get the sense of what your mind is like. So
I thought the thoughts were brain activity, and the mind is kind of aware of those thoughts, but is separate.
I think you're getting back beyond my realm of expertise now. You know, at the end of the day, I guess you could bring it all to neurological, you know, constructs, right? But ultimately, at least from a Buddhist point of view, the thought is a thing that the mind throws up, you know, that the thoughts appear, you know, based on causes and conditions, based on our grasping nature, based on our, you know, attachment, aversion, you know, jealousy, whatever the state we're in, right? Thoughts appear based on that, right? So that's kind of like that, you know. So I guess thoughts are basically neurons firing in the brain. That is true. But I think it's more than that. But if you ask me how is it more than that, I probably wouldn't be able to tell you right. Not right now, at least. I'd have to look it up or at least think about it some. Then the people also ask questions like, okay, if you have a thought in a dream, is that a thought? You know, then, so, you know, you can really go down the rat hole. I mean, you know, you have to answer that for yourself. Yes.
So the other thing that seems to be in the mix here is awareness. So you have the thought, the mind, the awareness. Are they all one thing that you sort of separate out for, you know?
The awareness is the mind, right? The thought is, again, you know, I can only think of it as an analogy. You know, it's kind of like, you know, clouds that come up in the sky, you know, mm-hmm. Right? Well, that's not a good example because, again, clouds are different from the sky, right? So the water bubble is much more closer to me. It makes sense, right? It's the same thing. It's the same nature, but it's still different, right? So that's kind of like that. So thoughts are not the mind, certainly not the mind. Because if they were the mind, then we, you know, we would be essentially whatever our thoughts said we were, right? But we're not, actually, right? I mean, because, well, once we tame our minds, we see that we're not what our thoughts say we are. I mean, like we were talking about this last time, right? We tend to, you know, we give solidity to our thoughts, right? We don't recognize that they're water bubbles, right? We think they're the stream, right? So, so we give the thought solidity, and then we give it extra power by actually believing it, or believing them, right? That they're right. And then, of course, you know, it's, you know, that's where the suffering and all that stuff the Buddha talked about comes from, right? So, as we talked about last time also, the mind is kind of like the mirror, right? It reflects, it's an awareness, right? So, but it's an awareness that is just sitting there, right? It sees things, not sees as in with our eyes, but it perceives, it's aware of things. It doesn't make judgments, or it's just aware. So for example, in the mirror, the person that appears in the mirror is not the person, right? It's a reflection of a person, right? So the mind is like that, you know, it just reflects what's the stimuli coming are. So anyway, so there are many analogies they use. The mirror is one, you know, the mountain that reflects off a lake is another one, you know, the lake being the clarity of the lake is like the mind's clarity, and, you know, and so forth and so on. So there's many, you know, analogies they use to describe the mind. Okay. So we talked about the motivation, right? And why is motivation important? And the main thing is that remember that in Buddhism, nothing happens by chance, right? It happens because of causes and conditions that bring it to fruition, right? So to achieve our goals, whether they are goals of this life or spiritual goals, whatever those goals happen to be, we have to actually create the conditions and causes for them to occur, to actually bear fruit, right? So the motivation is a way to plant the seeds, right, for those causes and conditions, right? In this case, our goal is, you know, spiritually oriented, right? So our motivation is about, trying to remove our delusions and helping others. You know, that's the Rinpoche says that's the most powerful motivation that we can use. Is benefiting others because it has, because it's so expansive, right? If you remember, the bodhicitta motivation is not just enlightenment for oneself, but to bring all beings to enlightenment, every cockroach, every fish, every insect, every, you know, alien, I guess, you know, on different planets. So, every single being to enlightenment because they are just as deserving as we are, right? And they are suffering just as much as we are. So because of that expansiveness, the motivation actually has a great power, right? And we also can change our environment with our motivation, right? Well, forget the environment for a minute, but the chances are that if we set the motivation for something to happen, it probably will happen. You have to set, you know, you have to kind of make the, create the environment for it, right? We have to plant the seeds in our minds for that to happen. I don't know. Did that explain? I mean, you understand what I'm saying? Okay. Right. Because sometimes I talk, but I'm not sure actually whether I'm conveying anything, you know. Oh, wait a minute. It says here, read Rinpoche's teaching on motivation, August 7th. Okay, hang on. I have it in my notes. I wish I hadn't been speaking because I could have just... Okay, where is it? Okay. So, Rinpoche was this is this year's retreat. So, he said, before doing, well, in this case, he was doing walking meditation. But anyway, before doing meditation, you generate bodhicitta, right? That attitude of being of ultimate benefit to others, right? And that you're doing it for to bring numberless sentient beings to pureless happiness, right? That's the motivation. So it creates, you know, if nothing else, it creates the seeds, it creates the merit, you know, if you will, right? The positive merit for things to happen, good things to happen, right? Not just this life. Remember, this is a long, again, we talked about this last time, this is a long view, right? We're not talking about this life. We're talking about this life, the next life, the one after that, the millionth one, the trillionth one, the one after 1,000 eons, and so forth and so on, right? So we're setting the seeds for to things to happen in those, you know, far, far away. And when you go to the module on karma, you will learn about how just a small seed, you know, planted in this life here, in 1,000 or 10,000, whatever lifetimes, grows into a gigantic tree. And so every small thing we do in this life has great power, right? So anyway, so that's the reason for motivation. She says, so Rinpoche said, so many people walking, jogging, going on motorcycle, okay? Walking, jogging, going on motorcycle, but not collecting merit because of no bodhicitta, right? Instead, you can make... This is the important one. Instead, you can make every action cause for happiness all the way up to enlightenment. Right? So no matter what you're doing, if you have the proper motivation, right, it can become a cause for happiness in the future, right? All the way up to enlightenment. Yeah, so that was kind of what, that was one of some of the things that he was talking about in motivation. So because, you know, as you'll see, you know, as you come to the center and as you do, you know, if you come to the, you know, like the Tara practices, you come to the Soga, you know, whatever, all the different pujas that they do and so forth and so on, and you'll notice that they are all bookend, you know, there's all these motivations in the beginning. There's all the stuff in the middle, and then there's this dedication at the end, and everything is built for us to collect merit. You know, be able to create the causes and conditions for future happiness, right? Enlightenment, you know, the sorrowless state, as the Buddha put it, right? To gain the sorrowless state. So that's why all those things are there, and that's why we do all this, is because, you know, if you're going to spend the time, you might as well spend it in the best way possible, right? Okay. Well, similarly, the cause, you know, why rejoice? Rejoicing is actually a incredibly powerful way of, again, you know, creating those causes, positive seeds, without much effort. You know, you don't have to do much, right? And they go in, you know, there are other modules that will go into more detail about rejoicing. I think I'm one of the ones who actually, I think I'm the one who does that module. But in any case, you know, so the idea about rejoicing is that, you know, how, you know, it's kind of, you know, it's a antidote to selfishness, right? Because you're so happy that someone else is happy, right? Oh, they got a new car. How wonderful. Instead of thinking, oh, gee, I wish I could get a new car. Why do I have to wait, you know, I'm blah, 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 right? So you rejoice. How wonderful that he got a new car, right? Or he, whatever. You know, David Mack, you know, yeah, David, he's off to Fiji right now. And I could say, well, you know, I wish I could go to Fiji, right? But it's wonderful that he's able to go to Fiji, right? So, like that. And of course, rejoicing in, you know, so the object of the rejoicing, right? The how much spiritual, the spiritual level of the object actually also increases the amount, you know, the benefit from rejoicing. So in other words, if I rejoice that David has gone to Fiji, you know, I collect a certain amount of merit and so forth and so on, right? But if, for example, if I rejoice that Gesula has gone to Nepal right now to, you know, find the sculptor who's going to build the Lama Tisha statue here, right? You know, and I'm, you know, if I, and I rejoice how wonderful that he's doing this for us, right? Because he's a higher being, right? That has much more power, right? Similarly, if you rejoice about the bodhisattvas, or if you're, you know, Catholic or whatever, the saints and so forth and so on, it doesn't have to be, you know, the bodhisattva. You can pick your own people or beings who inspire you, you know? So like that, rejoicing in their efforts has even more power, right? And finally, the Buddha's, you know, rejoicing in the Buddha's efforts. You know, you can rejoice in the fact that Lama Tsongkhapa, you know, did so much. The only reason that we have all these teachings, I mean, you know, Buddhism died off in India, right? It could have been the end of it. The only reason it survived and we are where we are today is because of Lama Tsongkhapa and all his efforts and his, you know, his two disciples who are here, you know, by the way, this is Lama Tsongkhapa, you know, right underneath the Buddha, right? From the 14th century. And those are his two disciples. Kedrup Jin, Gelsub Jin. But in any case, so all the refers and all the teachers who the lineage that, you know, from whom we are receiving the teachings finally coming to Rinpoche and to us, right? So we can rejoice and all. So anyway, so rejoicing is also creates, you know, great merit like that, right? And I think Rinpoche said something about that too. I was just going through my notes one day and I just was, oh yeah. He says, and he tells this story, I guess, you know, it's only time, I'll just tell the story. He says, it's very, 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 very important practice. Okay? He said, the success of this life, of future lives, of eliminating all our obscurations because of which we have our delusions and suffer, all depends on merits, right? That's the only reason, that's the only way we're going to get out of this quagmire, the swamp. The only way we can drain the swamp, okay, is by creating the positive seeds. Right? That's the only way we can get out of it. Is that when the seeds mature, things will happen, we will continue on our spiritual path, right? Because after we die, you know, there's more things coming. So anyway, so then he told a story of this, oh yeah, he told the story of this rich Indian family in Hong Kong who had many buildings, lived life royally, but never thought about other sentient beings. You know, there were so many people without food or shelter, but they you know, they were, had all this money, they were living, you know, they had made, there was a big, you know, real estate, you know, like the Trump of, you know, the Indian Trump of Hong Kong, right? Anyway, so they didn't do anything for anybody, they just kind of, you know, guarded it for themselves. So anyway, so then this recession happened in 2007, right? The economy tanked. And, you know, suddenly, basically, they were in dire straits. So then no money. He had no money, but still, you know, lived in this expensive house to keep up, you know, keep face, right? In the rich society. So all the responsibility fell on this guy, the son, to make money. And he was consumed by fear, right? And the reason Rinpoche got to hear about this is because this guy happened to know the center director, somehow or other, he knows the center director at Hong Kong, you know, the director of the center in Hong Kong. So basically what happens, you know, all his friends left him, they were fair about their friends, right? So basically he had nobody to talk to, right? He was by himself, all this pressure, right? And he was going crazy, and whatever he did, there was no success, right? And so Rinpoche says he had no one to talk to. He kept ringing up Pemba. This is the center director. He kept ringing up Pemba, and kept bothering him, he would listen to him, but there's not much he can do. So Rinpoche told him, this guy, right, the real estate guy, told him to recite the Arya Sanghata Sutra 60 times for his business. And he never thought even about the meaning of even one verse. Yeah, so anyway. So then Rinpoche says, he came to a recent teaching of Rinpoche, and he was crying that no one likes him, his family, his children have left him, And so Rinpoche says, he didn't think of karma. Right? This is karma. Right? When they were wealthy, he says, they should have been useful and benefited sentient beings. Even if you're not a Buddhist, even if you're not making offerings to the Buddha Dharma Sangha, do something for sentient beings, right? That's the way we create the karma, we create the causes, right? This family created the causes. This guy created causes in previous lives. He must have done incredibly amazing. Wealth is a product of wealth is a consequence of generosity, right? So this guy must have been incredibly generous in previous lives to be this rich in this life, right? Same with Trump, by the way. Must have been a wonderful person. Okay, so you know, don't knock him. So this guy was a wonderful. Must have been a wonderful person in previous lives, right? But in this life, he wasted it, right? So he said, what Rinpoche is saying is, you don't have to be Buddhist. You don't have to make offerings to the Buddhas and all this other stuff. Just try to be a benefit to others, right? So he says, charity is very important. You know, charity and motivation, these things, right? We're talking rejoicing, you know, all these things, right? That create merit. Important, and I remember he said this. He says, he was left handed because the right hand is, is parallel. No, it doesn't work very well, right? He goes, write it down. He says, write it down, you know, this part, right? That we have to be a benefit to others and think about others because we need to create the causes to drain the swamp, right? That's otherwise we will continue to be in the swamp. Right. Oh, yes, question back there. I hope I'm going to get to the two types of meditation today.
Hi. So if you're rejoicing for another person, are you opening your heart to the possibility that in that other person, those possibilities now become your possibilities?
Maybe.
That because you can be happy for other people or wish other people happiness, that it kind of transforms the process that goes on in your head and in your heart?
Well, it's certainly, It certainly softens your heart, right? There's no question about it, right? It certainly opens our hearts. It softens our hearts, makes us more willing to think about others. All those things, right? But it also enables us to, you know, for aspirations to come true, right? We all have aspirations, right? Certain, you know, maybe for this life, maybe for other aspirations, you know. But for those aspirations, you know, to happen, we have to cultivate, right? And, you know, for example, one of the things they say is, you know, if you're a gardener or if you're a farmer, you know, if you're a gardener, let's say, and you want to have a nice flower garden, right? What do you do? You know, you don't just put the seeds in the ground and just forget about them, right? You know, you first till the soil, right, to remove all the rocks and the stones and all this other stuff, right? Then you put fertilizer, right? That's going to be really rich and so forth and so on, right? Then you carefully put the seeds in the right places and all that stuff, right? And then you water the seeds, right? The sun has to, and it has to be in the sun, you know. The sun has to shine, the water has to, only then will the seeds sprout, right? So aspirations are like that, right? We have to do all those things, you know, water, fertilizer, and the tilling, by the way, is the purification part of it, right? That's the, you know, so collecting merit is the, you know, the water and the fertilizer and all that stuff, right? So we have to collect the merit, and we also have to purify our negative seeds that we've created, right? But that's a different, you know, class and different, yeah, so forth. We'll talk, you know, that's coming up later. But, so, where was it going? Yes. So rejoicing, motivation, dedication, all these things are creating those, you know, the conditions for those seeds to sprout. So I answered your question, but an indirect way. I'm not sure I gave you a direct answer, but I hope that was good enough. Okay. So dedication, by the way, is a similar thing, right? So dedication seals whatever merit we've created in our practice, whatever we, you know, not just in our practice, you know. You can dedicate many things. You can dedicate your day at work, you know. You know, maybe you did something good today, you know, in your work. You can dedicate it, you know. You can dedicate, you know, we make food offerings, for example, right? Those are dedications, you know, those are also dedications, right? And so dedication, like, it seals, if you will, the positive seeds that we've collected with those actions, right? So, and then the most powerful, there's a couple of ways of dedicating. One is with bodhicitta, you know, the mind of great compassion. And the other one is through emptiness. I won't go through the emptiness one, but Rinpoche says the dedication from the viewpoint of benefiting others is the most powerful one, right? And one of the things is that if you dedicate, you also learn in the karma section that anger is one of these, the strongest emotion or state of mind, right? The most, you know. And so anger has this, if you're angry, for example, not only do you create negative seeds for the future, but actually also, supposedly, it decreases your previously collected positive seeds, right? So it's like a double whammy, right? So dedication, on the other hand, if you dedicate, you seal that. You know, anger cannot take, that's what they say. Anger cannot destroy those positive seeds that you've collected, if you've dedicated them. Right? You know, so you can dedicate, you know, I mean, Rinpoche, for example, you know, he dedicates, you know, all his actions in the past, all his actions in the future, all his present action. You know, you can dedicate anything, right? So anyway, so that's dedicated, you know, and I'll give you an example of this, how important it is. When Rinpoche, Geshe-la's teacher, Kensur Rinpoche, he is the abbot of, he's the abbot of Sera Monastery now, in near Bangalore in India. So he was visiting here, I don't know, five, six, 7 years ago, something like that. And so I went to a meet, you know, I went to visit him. I went, you know, and one of the questions I asked him, I said, you know, I talked to him about my spiritual aspirations that I have in this life. And we talked about that for a while. And then I said, okay, so what's the best way? How can I make sure the best way to create the causes for that, for me to achieve those things in this life? Right? And he said, every time you dedicate to those aspirations. You think about your aspirations when you're dedicating. Right? That's the best way you can create causes for those things to come true. Right? So that tells you how powerful they are. These things that, rejoicing, motivation, dedication, these things are incredibly powerful. Okay, anyway. Somebody had a question back there.
Could you explain a little bit more about bodhicitta? I'm still having kind of difficulty understanding the concept.
Well, bodhicitta is, there's compassion, compassion, which is feeling sorrow, I guess. You know, love is defined as, delight in others' happiness, and compassion is, feeling sorrow for others' suffering. Right? And great compassion, which is bodhicitta, right? So this is the attitude that, that the bodhisattvas, the ones who are training they're very advanced already on the path to enlightenment, before they become Buddhas. There's 10 levels of bodhisattvas. And that's the attitude that they have, which is that everything that they do, the only reason they do it is if it's a benefit to someone. Right? That's their constant, state of mind, really. So, and not just a benefit, they're basically, there's a story, for example, I can't remember which bodhisattva it was now. But anyway, it might have been one of the Buddha's, the Jataka tales. It might have been one of the, Buddha's previous life stories. But in any case, so there was this bodhisattva. He was, So there was this bodhisattva, and he was, had to do one more thing, and he would be enlightened, right? But he said, I can't do that because all these other people, all these other beings are still stuck in the mire, right? So he said that I will work for them first. I will make sure they get there before I attain enlightenment, right? I will take on the responsibility of their enlightenment, making sure they get there, right, before I think about myself. It's a really incredibly mind-blowing thought, really, attitude. And the reason Rinpoche always says, he spent so much time, you go on a, like a two-week retreat, by the 12th day, you're still thinking whether he's going to start on the topic or not, because he's only talked about bodhicitta so far, right? And because, you know, our lives are relatively small, right? We're not Mother Teresa who's going and doing all these, you know, amazing bodhicitta things, right? You know, we do little things here and there, right? We have our reaches, you know, not so much, right? But we can have the attitude, right? If we have the attitude, it will grow over time, right? And it's the attitude, you know, and they say also, it's not just the attitude, not just the wish. You know, anybody can wish. I wish everybody could be happy, right? That's easy to do, right? But there has to be kind of like an action behind it, right? You have to make a commitment that, yes, I'm going to try to make an effort, right? Whether it's with body, speech, or mind, I will say something nice to somebody, or I will, you know, feed the hungry, or whatever it is, right? But we make the effort, right? And over the, you know, remember, again, it's a long view, right? Maybe we won't become bodhisattvas for 10 million eons, right? But for us to become bodhisattva 10 million eons from now, we have to have that attitude today. Otherwise, it won't happen. So that's the bodhicitta attitude, that I will take the responsibility to save everyone else. Along with my path, I will help others as well to keep going. So. It reminds me of the story that Geshe-la told once. Either it happened to him directly, or when he was teaching in Mexico, it happened to one of the students. So anyway, this happened directly to him, or one of his students told him what happened to him. But in any case, one of them was, you know, they were walking down the beach, right? And they saw this guy, you know, standing on the beach, and he was picking up those, you know, what do you call them? Sand dollars? What are those little things that just, Starfish? No, the little tiny, yeah, something like that. One of those little shell, I don't know. Anyway, they're basically these little tiny animals that keep getting washed up on shore, and then they get beat, you know, I guess they would die, right, because they have to be in water. Anyway, so this guy was standing there and just picking up one and throwing it into the water, picking up another one, throwing it in the water, he was doing this. And I guess the student was like, you know, it was a mile away, and he was watching this guy, and he was walking. And he finally passed him, and he looked at him. This guy said, you know, this not, you know, you realize this is not going to make any difference because there's a billion of them, right? So the guy picks up another one of those, throws it back into the ocean, he says, made a difference with that one. Right? So that's the kind of like, he had the bodhicitta attitude, but he's making a small, you know, that, it's a small effort, right? But he's making that effort, right? So that's the kind of mindset we have to have, right? So, anyway. No, I don't think he'd be picking up jellyfish. I don't want to pick up jellyfish. No, it's those little tiny things. There's, you know, I don't. I can see them, but maybe they're sand fleas. I don't know what they're called. Yeah, I can see them in my head, but I can't remember what they're called. Okay, so back to the actual topic at hand. So there's two main kinds of meditation. Right? One is what we've been doing. It's called placement meditation, right? We place the mind on an object and we just, you know, focus on it, right? With single-pointed concentration. And, you know, it develops, you know, develops concentration, you know, a mind that cannot be distracted. Because once the mind is, once you gain a mind that cannot be distracted, right? It's an amazingly sharp mind. Whatever it puts itself to task, right? Whatever it then tries to do, it has an amazing power. It can accomplish things much, much more quickly because it has such, like a knife edge, right? You know, point to it. So that's why they say this mind, you know, and you'll hear about this later on, called calm abiding, you know, towards the end of the chapter, end of the Lamrim's, you know, book, you know, there's the, you know, the calm abiding section where, you know, when you get to the 10th level of calm abiding, by the way, that is achievable in this lifetime. Okay? They say that if the cause and conditions are there and you've put the effort to it, you can achieve calm abiding in 6 months, maybe a year, but you have to go into retreat for six months to a year, and you could get to calm abiding. So, anyways, that's achievable in this life, but that's not the end, right? It's a means to an end, right? Calm abiding just gives you this incredible mind that whenever it places itself on an object, is there and unwaveringly stays there without any effort for as long as it wants. It doesn't get distracted by anything, right? So that's the concentration meditation, right? But that mind, when applied to, let's say, emptiness, when applied to compassion, when applied to, you know, different things, right, different topics, it can slice through and get to the heart of it incredibly quickly. And gain those realizations really quickly. So that's why that mind is so powerful. So that's the placement meditation, right? Which is what we've been doing. And by the way, the breath, the mind itself, those were two objects we talked about. Another one you can use is, if you are so inclined, this works for me. The breath, by the way, I find incredibly difficult. I cannot meditate on the breath. It doesn't work for me. So what I do, I can do visualizations, right? So you can take any visualization, any object, you know, whatever it happens to be, but you can't, you know, let's say, okay, so I use as a visualization, for example, this image of a Buddha, right? Because I have constructed this image from the statue that I really like at this other retreat center called Vajrapani in California where I used to live. And so I have that image in front of me, right? Very vivid image. And I just focus on that, right? That's my object of, you know, concentration, placement, meditation, right? The important thing is, you can use anything as an object, right? Like, let's say that, I use that, you know, that tanka of, I can't see from here, but tanka of Lama Tsongkhapa, I think, yeah. I can't see very well. But anyway, so let's say I use a tanka of Lama Tsongkhapa as my object of meditation, right? The important thing is not to look at it and just concentrate, right? That's not meditation because it's not using the mind. It's using our eyes, right? So what you have to do is you have to really look at the object, concentrate on it, and then make a mental picture. Then you sit there. Ow. It's going to cramp. Never mind. Then you just sit there and you just focus on the image, right? And you can use a coffee pot, you know. I mean, it doesn't matter, you know, that's not. But there is one of the reasons they say to use holy objects, by the way, if you're going to use a visualization to use, you know, object of the Buddha or a saint or, you know, or Jesus Christ, if you so feel like it, whatever, a holy object is because you not only are you getting the benefit of the concentration, et cetera, but you're also, you're also receiving their blessings, right? There's an, you know, because the power of the object again, right? So it has another benefit to it, which is you're collecting merit while you're meditating, you know? Why not? Right? Rinpoche is all about collecting merit. so that we can achieve our spiritual goals and help others, right? So that's the visualization that you can use to use in your concentration meditation. And the second type of meditation is called analytical meditation. And this is to deeply understand something through experience, you know, as if you are experiencing it yourself, right? So, you know, it's kind of like, for example, like being able to generate compassion for someone as if you had that experience of that someone, right? So in the analytical meditation, you would think about, you know, this experience of this person, and you just bring up all the things that they've been struggling with and so forth and so on, right? And you can generate that compassion feeling in yourself, right? For example, all the Lam Rim topics, right? You know, like you start in the Lam Rim, you know, the graded. By the way, do people know what I mean when I say Lam Rim? No. Okay. Lama Tsongkhapa, here in the middle, his great work was called Lam Rim, which is the great treatise on the stages of the path to enlightenment, which are out there in three volumes in English. And it basically, he was an enlightened being, number one, right? Enlightened being. But his great contribution was that he took all the words of the Buddha and all the commentaries, like all the Indian masters who had made all these commentaries, like Aryasura, Nagarjuna, you know, etc. And he took them and he synthesized it in this form that you can go from step one to step two to step three to step four, all the way to the sorrowless state. You know, all the things you have to do gain, the realizations you have to gain to get to the end, right? He was able to create. So that's why he called it the great treatise on the stages of the path to enlightenment. You know, you start from stage zero to stage whatever. And they're like 23, 24, 25, depending on how you count meditations in there, right? Topics. So each of those topics, for example, the first topic is impermanence, the idea that everything is in flux, right? Which we know in our head intellectually, right? But we don't know in our hearts, in our mind, we have not realized that idea, that understanding. We don't have that understanding. Because if we did, right, if we really understood impermanence, you know, we wouldn't get so upset when our car gets dinged. Right? I mean, that's a simple example. There are many other examples, of course. Right? I mean, so, you know, we wouldn't get upset when we get blamed for something unfairly. Things change, you know? That person changed. Right? You know when they say, that's not the person I married, you know? Well, yeah. That person was never going to be the person you married. Because the person you married was the person at a particular state at point in time. Not only that, it's my perception of that person at that particular point in time, right? There's like a couple of degrees of, you know, separation there. In any case, so that's what it is. So there is this topic on impermanence, the first topic, right? There's impermanence and there's death, you know, then there's, you know, karma, blah, 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 it goes on. So you do the analytical meditation in your mind saying, you know, keep going over how things are impermanent, you know, like you try to think of examples. Is there anything that actually is always, can I find a counterexample? Like, is there something that does not change, right? And you do this, and you look at it, you probe it, continuously, right? So, for example, When I do a meditation in impermanence, I think about, there's a famous four, I don't know who wrote it, but the famous four-line verse. Some Indian master wrote it 2,000 years ago. He says, accumulation ends in dispersal, rising ends in falling, meeting ends in parting, and birth ends in death. Right? Oh. Accumulation ends in dispersal, rising ends in falling, meeting ends in parting, and birth ends in death. So that shows you that there's nothing permanent. Right? Every single thing, right? Like, even if you think of your biggest, you know, like most, you know, enemy, like the thing, person that you dislike the most, you know? Well, maybe you really have an enemy, right? You know, even that enemy is not permanent, right? Either that person will die or you will die. Right? Seriously. Right? But, as they say, the mind is constantly with us. It's the one thing that you cannot escape from. Every other thing you can escape in some form or fashion. So that mind is, that's why we have to work on our mind so much. So anyway, so back to impermanence. So one would think about that, those four verses, right? Accumulation and how, you know, so like, think about the examples of how things you accumulated, you know, things you collected, you know, somehow got stolen or you lost it in the recession or whatever, blah, 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 right? All these ways in your life that is things that have happened in other people's lives. You start to think of counterexamples. You look at other texts and you say, okay, what are other things people have said? And you kind of like, you know, so you probe at it from all these different angles, right? And then you come to a realization, unshakable. When a realization means an unshakable belief, right? This is like, it becomes your core, right? Nobody can come and say something, you know, like we are so, you know, one day somebody tells us something, we say, okay, that makes sense. Next day somebody says exactly opposite, oh yeah, I guess that makes sense, right? We're like so, you know, willing to be influenced, right? But when you have a realization, you know it to be true. You cannot be moved, right? That's when it's in your heart. You know, like when you, that's when you live that thing, live that realization, right? Right? That then you don't have to, you know, when your car gets dinged, we're like, okay, yeah, it was about to ding, get dinged anyway. If not today, it was going to get dinged tomorrow, right? So then that's how we transform our minds, right? So the analytical meditation is, that's what it's about, to analyze, to probe, right? And that's what the Lam Rim, the stages on the treatise, you know, is all about, right? Every one of these meditations, like, you know, one of the required, I'm not going to hold the party line here, right? But one of the required readings is, you know, the How to Meditate book, right? It's a wonderful book. When I came across that book 20 years ago when it was like, you know, in India, you know, they were publishing it in India, like in these mimeograph sheets, and, you know, now it's so nice with pictures and stuff, you know. But anyway, it's a great book about all the different meditations you can do, right? On the stages on the path to enlightenment, written in wonderful, accessible English. And that's what those are all analytical meditations. And you can, if you, every day, if you spend some time and you think about impermanence, let's say, you know, after a while, it'll become part of you, right? Your mind will be transformed in that, at least from the impermanence side, right? Maybe you still fear death, but because you haven't got that realization yet, right? But impermanence, at least, you will have, right? So like that, that's called analytical meditation. And the way that I'll finish now, but I'll just say one thing is, when we do analytical meditation, we're trying to do the meditation and our mind starts wandering and, you know, it's kind of hard to like hold the object, you know, object of impermanence, right? kind of like continue to stay up with it, you know. That's where a well-concentrated mind, that's where it comes in, right? That's where it basically, the knife edge really makes a difference, right? That's why they have to go together, right? You do the concentration meditation and you know, the concentration meditation creates that mind, that mind that can really probe and really can just go right through, right? And then you have to use it on with the analytical meditation on, you know, these different topics to gain those realizations. Okay. Any really burning question, because I'm already slightly over my time? Oh, yes. Okay, let's do the dedication first.
Yeah.
So, very short, chapter, page 36. So, due to the merits of these virtuous actions, oh, sorry. Not everyone has gotten to the page yet. So really, try to imagine that, you know, that whatever we've spoken and said and heard and thought about today, you know, that may be a benefit to not just us, to all beings, that we may be the instrument to their for their enlightenment, that we may be of service to them in this life and all our future lives and our past lives. Okay. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel Bodhicitta that has not arisen arise and grow, and may that which has arisen not diminish but increase more and more. For your homework, I would like you to, you know, have some kind of practice where you're spending, you know, you can pick 5 minutes, whatever it is, your actual meditation time, but with the motivation and the, you know, the dedication and the rejoicing and all those things kind of built into it, right? And also, if needed, you know, actually start with the 9-round breathing. That's always helpful. But you can do the body scan if you need more, you know, that's not enough and so forth and so on, right? So if you could do that for the next 2 weeks. Yeah. Okay. We'll see you in 2 weeks from today. Hope you have a good Thanksgiving, right? And these meditations may help you calm your minds before you have to face your enemies at Thanksgiving.
Shankar mentioned the Lam Rim, so I felt like I should be announcing, if you feel very motivated over Thanksgiving weekend, we have a 3-day...
Oh, yes. Yes, I was going to say it.
Do you
want to say it? No, please, go ahead.
A 3-day Lam Rim, I don't know if you call it retreat or study, but if it's from 7 a.m. to...
It's like a retreat.
Like a retreat here from 7 a.m. to 5 p.m. Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So it's meditation sessions is my understanding.
Yeah.
And the leaders ask that you come to all 3 days if you're going to do it. It's important to have the whole sense of it. This Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. More information on the website. This is the book that Shanka was talking about. I will say that I took this class for the first time 14 years ago, and I go to this book over and over and over again. But it sounds like we don't have to buy it. But right. But we do have a bookstore volunteer here, so if you want to get it tonight, that's what he's here for, to help you get this. And I believe there... Oh, that's not good.
There might be one copy in the library. So mm-hmm. Whoever's there first.
Yeah, it does divide it into the analytical and visualization meditations. The last thing is just, Shankar also said, you know, our point is to be of benefit. That's the point of the center. It's up to us to keep the center going with donations and with helping out. So if you want to help empty the water bowls or any of the after-class tasks, I'm here to help you figure out how to help out. And there's a sign on your way out about text giving, and I tried it today as a test, and it worked really well. You text, and it sends you to a website, then you get set up, and then you can just text future donations. So we're getting all...
By the way, I was going to say that empty water bowls and, of course, offering water bowls have also great merit, you know, associated with them. So it's actually not just the physical activity, there's actually more benefit to doing it.
Yeah. What's up? Because there's always more. Thank you.